You're listening when you know you're listening. And developing that consciousness as a constant stream in your life is hugely beneficial. I think Hemingway said, "I like to listen. I've learned a great deal from listening carefully. Most people never listen." So it's a huge advantage in life to develop this consciousness that you're doing something. It's work, it's a skill, you can practice it, you can master it, and it's worth it.
Welcome to Partnership Plus, your go-to source for modern partnership wisdom with your host, Phil Hayes St. Clair.
Hey, it's Phil, and in this episode of Partnership Plus, we welcome Julian Treasure. Now, if that name is not familiar to you, well, maybe this will help. Julian has delivered a number of TED Talks, and they have been viewed more than 150 million times. What's the topic? How to be heard. Julian will share with us all of his tips and tricks for how to listen, how to speak to be heard, and how to be understood. This is a fabulous masterclass in how to really reorient the way we listen to understand. So without further ado, let's welcome Julian Treasure. Julian, as I said before, it is such a pleasure to be talking to you today. I'm a huge follower of your work, so thank you for your time today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for asking me, Phil.
So for people whose interest has just been piqued but don't know who you are, what is the Julian Treasure backstory?
I started out life as a musician. I'm a drummer. I don't know if I could describe myself as still a drummer. I have been a drummer all my life. I haven't played for a while now. And obviously, as a musician in the early 80s, this was ended up very broke. Not many make it. Made records and had a lot of fun. But I went into sales, actually, after that, eventually in magazine publishing, computer magazines, and worked my way up there to become marketing director of a sizable publishing company, and then left that to launch my own business. So that was the big leap. In 88, I launched a company called The Publishing Department, which then became TPD Publishing. And in 1990, I think, my partnership really began, because I recruited somebody, another me, really. And we built the company up. And that ended up having offices in London, Munich, and Seattle, employing about 140 people and producing magazines for companies like Microsoft, Apple, Orange, Lexus, and so forth. So it was custom publishing, customer magazines. So I learned a lot about branding in that 15 years from 88 through to 2003 when I sold that business. But all the way through, I was still a musician. I was listening to the world in the way musicians do, which is kind of a little bit more careful, perhaps, than most people. And I was very conscious the world was not sounding very good. It was noisy, especially the noise being made by companies who weren't thinking at all about the question, how does your brand sound? None. So when I sold TPD, I jumped for the second time and launched a company called The Sound Agency in 2003. And I ran that for 20 years until quite recently, when I finally closed it. After 20 years of auditing shopping malls all over the world and designing soundscapes for spaces and sonic logos for companies, I kind of wanted to focus on the epiphany I had halfway through the TED Talks, which we can talk about in a minute, when I realized that companies are making terrible sound for one reason and one reason only, which is that the people in them are not listening. So the conversation to me became less about corporate sound, corporate listening, and more about personal listening. And that was the last TED Talk was about personal speaking. The third one was about personal listening. And that's what I do now. And it's what I've done since I've moved out of audio branding and into teaching, as you said, people and organizations, of course, which are large groups of people, about the importance of listening and the importance of speaking, the two things we don't teach at school. They're both skills and we ignore them completely. And yet they profoundly affect our outcomes in life. So that's my passion now. My mission is to generate listening in the world.
I can't tell you how much I love that for so many reasons, which we're going to dive into in a second. In one of your TED Talks, How to Speak So That People Can Listen, again, link below. I loved seeing you have an auditorium full of people do your pre-talk routine. And I also love that question, which was, what would the world be like if we were creating sound consciously, consuming sound consciously, and designing all of our environments consciously for sound? I feel as though this has become something increasingly relevant, possibly in the last 5 years more than any other time. I have a particular sensitivity to this now, having had family members diagnosed being on the autism spectrum and learning more about how the sensitivity of sound is so large for them. And so difficult to empathize when that's not you. So now we have a greater understanding of the impact of how noise can play a role for that population of people. When you think about how people are gradually retreating from wanting to listen, is it because there is so much noise, physical noise being generated, or is it because people are just overwhelmed? Or is it maybe even a combination of both?
Those are two of the factors. Noise, definitely, it's getting louder every year because it's it's tracking population growth. We're a pretty noisy bunch, human beings, and the more of us there are, the more noise we make. And over half the world now lives in cities, which are noisy places. So, the average level of noise that a human being is exposed to is really extraordinary now. So that's one factor, definitely, and it tends to make you go numb. You know, you don't pay much attention to sound because most of the sound around you is just unpleasant noise. So you get into the habit of ignoring it. And yes, overwhelm, FOMO, technology, multiple streams of stuff coming at us, hundreds of emails a day. I don't know how many you get, but I find email very stressful. It's this kind of constant sense that you should be paying attention to something else, which takes us away from being here now, as the Buddhists would say. And I think that's a major issue with, the fragmented attention spans that we have now. Scott Peck said, you cannot truly listen to another person and do anything else at the same time. But we're always doing something else, aren't we? Or feeling that we should be doing something else. So I think technology is a really big obstacle to listening now. And of course, you're seeing the results of the lack of listening. I mean, I mentioned that we don't teach it in school in the first place, so it's kind of ignored from birth, really. And then it gets worse as we grow up and get more distracted. You're seeing the results of that worldwide. As you said, in the last 5 years, we've got deep fakes, we've got post-truth politics, we've got polarization, we've got demonization of huge numbers of people, trolling and internet pylons and all this sort of stuff. There's no listening there. Politicians go off and have talks. And as I often say, I wish they'd go off and have listens instead.
Yes.
I think the world would be a much better place. I'll give you another indication of this. My TED Talk on speaking, which is the one that's now, I think, the sixth most viewed TED Talk of all time, that's got five times as many views as my TED Talk on listening. So I think that says something. We are far keener to be heard than we are to listen, which is unfortunately an uneven equation, isn't it? If everybody's shouting and nobody's listening, that's not very good. So listening to me is the foundational skill, and that is the thing we desperately need to focus on because it's the basis of democracy. How can I live next to somebody with whom I fundamentally disagree if I don't listen to them and attempt to understand them? Because I say, always conscious listening always creates understanding. If I don't listen, the alternative is what happened in Rwanda a few years ago when neighbors were killing each other with machetes suddenly. So, we can't take stuff for granted here. We have to start listening.
Julian, was there a? I'd like to share a story with you about when the profound nature of listening hit me, which was over 15 years ago. And I'm wondering if you have a time in your life where it became very clear to you that this needed to be a priority that you would speak to. I remember being asked to come along to a round table in the bush, which was essentially a retreat in a rural part of Australia. And it was there to talk about the environment. And there were a number of people that were brought there specifically to have conversations away from technology and to really connect with our background and our environment. And there's a very famous Australian reporter who I won't mention here. He and I got paired, and it was the first time I'd ever met him before. And I remember him asking me questions, and he sat across from me one night, and all he did was look straight into my soul, and nothing else could have possibly distracted him from what I was saying. And I'm sure what I was saying was not useful, but his craft was more or less to absorb all of it so that he could process. And I've seen him do that to everybody else that he speaks to. And I wonder if that's a journalistic trait, but at that point, even before I had children, where I now realize just how important it is to be right into conversations with them, because I know how quickly this time is going to pass. We have young kids, you know, between the ages of 9 and 12. But that was that moment for me where I think subconsciously decided that I would do much better job of listening so I could understand. Was there a moment for you like that in your life that the switch flicked?
First of all, what a wonderful experience for you to have had, because many people have never had that experience of being truly listened to. And, you know, dear listeners to this, how about giving that gift to somebody today? Put everything down, look at them, pay attention to them, give them your whole 100% attention. You know, you might get the response, what are you doing? Because people aren't used to being received in that way, unfortunately, right, in the world. So particularly with children, you know, if you're parenting small children, it's a wonderful thing. You teach them listening by listening to them. Go down to their level, you know, at eye level with them. So you have to get onto the floor and kneel down or something, be at their level and look at them and listen to what they're saying. It's a great, great gift to give your children. And, you know, just apropos of journalists, I'm not sure that is a regular occurrence for journalists now, that kind of listening. They're much more prone to interrupt, you know, 10 seconds into somebody's answer now, because it's all about combative journalism where you're pitting people against each other and, you know, making everything extreme in order to have a fight on the radio or on the television, which is unfortunate. So listening again is going by the board. For me, I think it's been more gradual than that. I think it's been because of being a musician. You know, if you're a musician, and incidentally, the research is quite interesting on this, musicians have bigger brains than non-musicians. There's a part of the brain, the central part, which connects the two hemispheres, which is enlarged. And it's not surprising if you think about what perhaps, I don't know, a concert violinist is doing when they're playing in an orchestra. They're reading a very complicated code of notes, which can be incredibly dense, and decoding that in their brain at the same time as they're doing some enormously sophisticated and subtle movements with both of their hands, at the same time as paying attention to everything else that's going on around them, the conductor, the rest of the orchestra. That is a lot of stuff going on at once. And it's combining a lot of strands in your brain. So the research now shows that musicians, not just professional musicians, but any musicians, anybody who plays anything, does better in lots of cognitive tests. So good piece of advice to everybody listening to this. Take up an instrument. It's never too late. Teach your children. Get them music lessons. It's really good for you. So for me, it was that because, you know, I played in bands. And if you're playing in, you know, as a drummer, you have to be listening to everybody. And so it's a multi-track listening, and it's very attentive, because if you're not doing that all the time, you're not playing very well. And I developed that kind of multi-track attentive listening, which for some reason I applied to everything I was doing, you know, meetings, being out in the street and so forth, paying attention to what was going on around me. And that to me is, you know, it's the first secret of listening is to be conscious that you're doing something. Listening is a skill. It's not a capability. Hearing is a capability. You hear everything, depending on how good your hearing is and if it's damaged, but you hear everything. Listening is where you select certain things to pay attention to, and then you make them mean something. So my definition of listening is making meaning from sound. And that's a conscious process. So when we relegate it to, yeah, I'm always listening. No, you're not. You're listening when you know you're listening. And developing that consciousness as a constant stream in your life is hugely beneficial. I think Hemingway said, I like to listen. I've learned a great deal from listening carefully. Most people never listen. So it's a huge advantage in life to develop this consciousness that you're doing something. It's work. It's a skill. You can practice it. You can master it. And it's worth it.
When somebody approaches you wanting help to be better heard, what is it that you help them understand about themselves in order to achieve that?
Well, a lot of the time, I come back, if somebody says people aren't listening to me, then the first question is, are you listening to them? Because actually, generally, the best way to get somebody to listen to you is to give them the gift of listening. It tends to be something that cycles in a conversation. At the heart of my work is a simple model where most people think there's a straight line, I speak, you listen, straight line from one to the other. That's not correct. Actually, it's a circular relationship. Speaking and listening affect one another. The way I speak affects the way you listen. The way you listen affects the way I speak, and so on and so on. And understanding that circle is very important. So that's why I'm saying, if you want somebody to listen to you, try listening to them. And there's a little model I teach a lot of the time. It's RASA, which you would have come across in the TED Talk, I think. Yes. Did that there, which is receive, yeah. Appreciate, summarize, ask. So receive is pay attention, eye contact, maybe leaning forward slightly, appreciate is the little noises and gestures we make to show that we're engaged in the conversation. That kind of thing. The S summarizes so, where you close doors, maybe in the corridor of a long conversation. So what we're saying is this, or so what I heard you say is that, did I get you? That kind of summarizing, paraphrasing. And then the A is ask. Questions, open-ended questions, why, what, which, where, when, who, that kind of questions that don't permit the answer yes or no. And there's a great phrase, which I would tag on to the end of RASA, for anybody who wants to open the conversation and get somebody's attention and have them listen to you. Tell me more. Tell me more about that. You're showing that you're interested. You're teasing it out of them. And as they open up, then it'll become your turn and they will reciprocate much more than they would have done with the gift of their listening.
I love that. I often hear a colleague of mine that I speak to very frequently. He has a very regular way of saying to me, say more at the end of it. And it teases me out. And then we end up intending to have a 5-minute conversation, often turns into an hour long conversation because we've helped each other expand our thinking on whatever the topic is. I love that addition. So when we think about tone, in one of your talks, you mentioned that tone has a relationship to how you're perceived, and how I think you made a comment that we vote for politicians, at least in the UK, you vote for politicians who have a deep tone because it relates to strength, and that has a relationship to confidence. And I'm very curious for how people find that right tone, because a lot of people will think, I have one tone, I speak, noise comes out, and I try to be convincing with whatever tone that I have. But it feels though it's a little bit more complicated than that. And one of your suggestions was to have a speaking coach to help you sort of work out how you vary tone so that you can apply it in different contexts. Have I got that right?
Yeah, well, Phil, this is the instrument we all play, and again, we don't teach it in school, which is crazy. We teach reading and writing. We do not teach speaking and listening. This to me is absolutely bonkers, particularly since if you taught children in the first place how to listen really well, how much more of their education would they receive? It would make it a far more effective process. So, yeah, it's the instrument we all play, and you wouldn't want to walk on stage in the Sydney Opera House and give a piano recital without ever having had a lesson or understanding anything about the instrument. I mean, that would be obviously ridiculous. And yet, you know, I give talks around the world on these subjects to organizations, and I'll be talking to, you know, 500 senior managers, and I'll say, how many of you use your voice in work, giving presentations, selling things, leading teams, and so forth? All put their hands up. Okay, how many of you have had formal vocal training? About three. It's always about three. And what is going on? If this is an important aspect of your work, if your voice actually matters, if it affects your outcomes in life, then pay attention to it. And, you know, the heart of that TED talk that went ballistic was where I talked about the vocal toolbox, which is all the things that people don't realize they can pay attention to and use, tools they can pull out of the vocal toolbox to make them more effective and more powerful in their speaking. You mentioned tonality or timbre and pitch, another part of that. And I would include in there also prosody or prosody, which is intonation and the gaps between the words. So these things are all very important. I mean, yes, pitch is important. The thing about politicians with deep voices, that was actually American research. And it's not surprising because we tend to associate deep sounds with important things. I mean, an elephant is rather more important than a mouse in terms of survival. So, you know, there is this very, very long-standing association that deep voices are important. And therefore, we attach that to human beings. And, you know, if you had a politician who spoke like this, it wouldn't work very, it wouldn't work very well. You can change the way you resonate from, and that's just practice. I mean, of course, our voice all comes from our vocal cords in our throat, but at the same time, we're resonating. So I can resonate up here in my mouth and in my nose up here, or I can move down and resonate in my chest here. Now, that's a different sound, isn't it? And we tend to think that people with deeper voices have more authority. It's an association that's out there. So you can practice resonating in your chest. Just put your fingers on your throat and you can start to feel when you're resonating, or just below your throat, you know, the top of your rib cage here. You can feel when you're resonating in your chest and practice that. It's a good practice to do. And you know, prosody, the sing-song of speech, using your voice, if I spoke all the time on one note, that's called being monotonous. Monotone means one note. Monotonous means speaking on one note, literally. It's not very entertaining, is it? excuse me. And by the same token, repetitive cadences. And I have to point the finger at your lovely country for this, because there's a particular repetitive cadence that's really gone worldwide. It's called high-rising terminal, where you say everything as if it were a question. Even though it's not a question, it's actually a statement. You know, a lot of Australians do that for some reason, as well as saying, look, a great deal. But, you know, we all have our catchphrases and our habits. But that, unfortunately, is a rather weak intonation because it's eliding a kind of, is that okay, all the time. It's asking for approval with that tone of voice.
Yes.
So something that, you know, is, again, worth paying attention to is any repetitive cadences, because they're boring and they may not fit with what you're actually saying.
You mentioned the work you do with organizations and how they are seeking ways to improve collaboration, and so much of what we do in this partnership world relies, like I said before, on the listening and the speaking and the way to understand, and particularly the nonverbal cues that come with all of these things. Because in a multi-organization partnership where you don't get to sit shoulder to shoulder with everybody every single day, the ability to understand what's going on and how to read the plays and how to try and preempt what's going to happen and how to keep a certain level of health in a partnership is super important. In your experience, how can companies foster a culture of effective communication to help enhance that approach to collaboration?
Well, it starts from the top. You need to have listening leadership. And it's not enough to have autocratic leadership sending an email around saying tomorrow we'll be a listening organization. That doesn't work. And it needs to be that it's okay to challenge, for example. It's okay to make mistakes as long as they're not repeated mistakes. I've been in organizations, I'm sure you have, where, you know, challenge is not okay, where failure is absolutely not okay. And it's met with rage or, you know, dire consequences. And that's a culture of fear. And once you have that in an organization, there is no communication. People hide things. People, you know, make things up. And I've personally suffered a great deal from that in an organization, which bought my company and had a huge fail as a result of that exact culture where things were made up and things were suppressed. It was a very, very messy situation, all down to having an autocratic boss who would not accept failure at all. It needs to come from the top. You need to have processes in place which allow people to communicate and listen effectively in particular. You need to have recruitment, training, assessment, and reward, which are orientated in this way. So just as a simple example, if you have 360 reviews, is there a question in there that says, how good is this person at listening? And do the people who are very good at listening get rewarded for that in any way, shape or form? Now, this isn't just nice because, you know, there was a big piece of research done in your country, actually, by Professor Jim McNamara called the Organizational Listening Project. Well, it was done in Australia, but it was worldwide research. And they found, not surprisingly, that organizational listening was abject. Organizations were putting at least four times as much resource into sending as they were into receiving. Externally, that's not surprising. And when you say corporate communication, you immediately think of advertising, PR, social media, outbound, send. There's not a lot of receiving going on. And, you know, we've all had the experience of trying to communicate back to a big organization, which goes press one for this, press two for this. Your whole time will be 25 minutes to speak to, you know, we're experiencing higher than normal call volumes, all that bullshit, basically. I mean, it's not a good approach to start your relationship with a customer with an outright lie like that, which is what it normally is. So the listening, no, not very good. And what the Organizational Listening Project found is that the organizations which were rated as better listeners had better staff and customer retention, they had higher productivity, they had better results in all sorts of different metrics. The ones that were rated as the poorest listeners had more crises and more criticism generally. So listening pays. It actually has a return on the bottom line, better listening, not to mention, you know, avoiding being the next Kodak, where, you know, people will always need pictures, we'll be fine. You need to listen just like a squirrel listens all the time for danger. You know, he'll be eating his nut and looking up and listening. Most of all, it's our primary warning sense. And that should apply to organizations just as much as individuals. Although I have to say, Phil, these days when I see cyclists riding around with headphones on, I think we've lost contact with that primary warning sense somewhere along the line.
Yes, as a former competitive bike rider, I never ever had headphones in for the reason that I feared for my life. If that was the case, exactly. It's dangerous enough to be out there. Julian, when we think about nonverbal communication and the role that plays in engendering trust, maintaining trust, you know, I spend a lot of time and I see many people posture in very strange ways when they almost have made up their minds that they don't want to engage and communicate or listen to someone else. Yet there is huge value if you zoom out and look at the overall context for why two companies would have come together to achieve an outcome. I guess my question is, in your experience, how important is nonverbal communication in maintaining a strong relationship and strong partnerships?
I think body language is very important. I mean, I should say that age-old piece of research which is parroted repeatedly on the internet, which purports to show that nonverbal communication is 83% of communication, is rubbish. That is a very poor piece of research which has been repeated so many times that everybody now thinks it's true, and it's not true, and it didn't even say that in the first place. So be wary of that one. I think nonverbal communication is extremely important, but it's not as important as what you say and how you say it. Your voice is massively more powerful than your posture. I'm not saying posture isn't important. Of course it is. I mean, I teach people an exercise for posture, which is to imagine a string attached to the top of your head and everything dangling from the string. And that is simple and puts you immediately into a good, relaxed, vertical, shoulders down, everything's nice and relaxed posture, which is not going to be distracting or awkward. And, you know, posture can tell all sorts of stories. Look at Pamela Meyer's excellent TED talk on lie detecting. And she talks about people whose feet are pointing for the door, or who put obstacles on tables in between them and the other person, and all this kind of stuff. Yes, you can start to be an FBI lie detector. Absolutely. But the voice, nevertheless, is the most important thing. And that's true in video communication as well. You know, we talk about video conferencing, and lots of companies have a huge screen on the wall and one tiny little microphone in the middle of a table for 30 people in a room marble lined and glass walled and so forth, and expect that to work. And of course, if the video goes down, you can carry on perfectly well in sound only. If the sound goes down, what are you going to do? Use sign language, hold up bits of paper? I mean, it's actually audio conferencing with optional video. It's nice to see people, and you can then get the body language, but so much more of it comes from the voice and the way we use the voice. So to me, speaking and listening are the foundational, enormously primeval and vital skills of communication that we have, for some reason, sidelined since we invented writing. Only 5,000 years ago, we invented writing. And for some reason, the way we've communicated for hundreds of thousands of years before that has been just set aside. I want to reclaim it.
Can we revisit your RASA framework for a minute and put ourselves in a circumstance where there is a relatively young leader? Let's say that they're early 30s and they have a very important new role where they don't have a huge amount of leadership experience, enough for them to have achieved the role they've got. And they need to communicate something very important to a large group of people, let's say 400 or 500 people. It is in person, so there's not the technical layer that we've just talked about in terms of video conferencing. If you were to coach that person on how to prepare for that in order to create an excellent delivery, but also to give them a sense of, or some tools to help them understand in themselves whether their delivery was well received, can we just go through what that might look like? Because there are many leaders that listen to this show that I receive emails from and who I coach who do feel very underprepared in the aspect of not just speaking, but delivering and then allowing people to come towards them as part of that message so they can build trust with leaders who might be, you know, a number of layers removed from who they are.
Absolutely. A bit like coaching somebody to give a TED talk, which I've done also in the past. Let's separate the two things, content and delivery. First of all, content. And actually, before we even get to that, there's a very important question. What I teach about listening is that every human being's listening is unique because we listen through a set of filters. Now, we don't need to go into what those are at the moment, but you've come a different road to this conversation to me, Phil. You've had a different life. You listen through a set of filters which you've built up over your life. So do I. And that means it's a very powerful question to ask yourself, what's the listening I'm speaking into? Because it's not the same as yours. And that's the first mistake most people make. They assume, you know, you've got an audience of 400 people, you're just assuming they all listen like me. They're not going to be speaking to 400 you. They're going to be be speaking to 400 individual different people who come together at that moment to create a gestalt listening. And that changes through the day. You know, I'm often put on after lunch. So they think he's a TED talker, he can deal with it. You know, after lunch, everybody's had food, they're a bit sleepy, it's a bit slow, the blood's gone to their gut and so forth. It's called the graveyard shift. So the listening will change through the day, and it changes from person to person and group to group anyway, depending on what they've got going on too. So ask yourself the question, what's the listening I will be speaking into? And you can do that by analyzing the demographics, the psychographics as far as you can of the audience. Understand what are their problems, what are they worried about at the moment, why are they here, what are their intentions. So when you're designing content, bearing that in mind, what's the listening I'll be speaking to? There are three intentions you have to be clear about. There's your intention for you. There's your intention for the audience. What journey are you going to take them on? What gift are you going to give them that will leave them changed at the end of your 10 minutes or however long it is? And the third intention is their intention for them, which you have to guess. And it's a good question to ask yourself. If I were in that audience, what would I be wanting? So having done all that, you can then design your content to meet, as best you can guess, their intentions, your intentions for them, and your intentions for you. And you can ask yourself questions like, so what? Very important question. Put yourself in the audience's shoes. So what? Why would I care about this? A very good question to ask. So that's just a moment on content. Let's assume you've got a nice talk. It's going to be appropriate and it's going to be interesting to them. We're now into delivery, where I think a wonderful attitude to foster within the context of the phrase, it's not about you, because it's never about you. You know, when people go on stage and it's all about them, it's obvious and it doesn't connect with the audience. So it's not about you. What is it about? It's about a gift. Now, if you're about to give your child a Christmas present, you just imagine how you feel about that. Here you are. You're excited. You're happy. You're beaming. You're giving them something you know they're going to love. Walk on stage like that. I've got this great gift for you. I'm about to give you. And that's how you're feeling. And you will automatically do what I suggest people do going on stage, which is best. Let's breathe. Big breath in. Your voice is just breath. Expand your awareness to really take in the whole room. Take up your stance, string in the head, nice and relaxed, and smile because you're happy. You're going to give them a gift. And what you'll find is it makes a good connection with the audience and they will smile back. And then after that, it's about the vocal toolbox. It's about being conscious of what you're doing, taking them on that journey with them, interacting with them as, you know, you can give them exercises like I did in that TED talk, or simply ask questions, you know, hands up, how many of you, that kind of thing, you know, that it's all good to get the state change, to involve people in the talk. It's not just you lecturing them. Now, that's not a great way to be. And then at the end, absolutely, you've delivered your gift. They've now got something. They've moved from where they were 10 minutes ago to where they are now. They're in a different place. They know something new, or they're excited about doing something new. They're motivated in some way, according to whatever you've given them. And you can say at the end, I'm here. I'll be down at the bottom of the stage there. If anybody wants to come and have a chat with me about any of this and explore any of it, I'd be absolutely delighted to do that. And have a stack of business cards in your pocket. And off you go. Shake hands, meet people, swap business cards. And that's the way it works. Be available and listen to them as they come up. You know, that's the secret. So there's a tiny little potted masterclass in public speaking, I suppose. But there are some important principles in there which will help anybody to deliver a really good talk.
I do love that. I started my career in the army, and I remember having a company commander who I was very new to this battalion, and as a bunch of the new guys that were there, we were introduced to our platoons and our sections. And when the OC came around and he had a chat to us to welcome us, he said to us at the beginning of his talk, I will be here for as many questions as you have. And in the beginning, no one was willing to ask a question. You know, we were brand new soldiers. This was a major. We didn't really know how to communicate with him. But after a little bit of a warm up, you know, we were able to spend a good hour and a half where previously he had said to us afterwards, the longest this had ever gone for was 20 minutes. And I'll never forget the ability to stay behind afterwards and answer whatever question you had. It's, you know, that was for me 25, almost 30 years ago. And it's one of those things I've never forgotten.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Where does silence play a role, Julian? I mean, I've heard many people try and do a very clumsy pause for effect, as they might suggest, where it actually has not been well-timed. It's been, in most cases, designed to catch people out because they realize their audience has not been listening. Not particularly useful as a tool, as far as I can tell, but there is, in the cadences that I've seen when you speak, you do give the audience just a moment of pause to almost take in what you've said, process it a little bit before you serve the next level of insight. How should we think about silence in communication?
Very important. Silence is the baseline. It's the thing that makes music make sense. It's the thing that makes conversation make sense. It's the gaps between the words which allow you to make sense of them. Otherwise, it would just be a jumbled nonsense. And unfortunately, as I said, with half of the world, more than half the world in cities, many people don't experience silence at all, or, you know, very often. And unless you can get out into the country and do a bit of Shinrin Yoku, you know, forest bathing, and really experience the peace of nature, you know, many people have lost contact with this very important baseline. And it is critical. So I recommend getting silence or the nearest thing you can to it at least a couple of times a day for a few minutes, sitting peacefully and quietly. You can meditate if you like. You don't have to. Just be quiet. And let your ears recalibrate, and it will sharpen your listening and your appreciation of the sound around you. Also, it makes you comfortable. So becoming comfortable again with silence is very important for speaking. You don't have to fill every moment with ums and ahs and you knows. And indeed, that is one of the biggest mistakes I see people making, especially if they're nervous, is to start speaking very quickly and fill every bit of the talk with sound, which again starts to become just noise. So you need the gaps, and you can use pace to emphasize things. Now, you know, I give talks on stage, and on stage I can stop for the longest time. People are frightened of silence. You know, I can stop for a minute. That's a long time to stop and just stand there. Now, as long as I don't look distressed, the audience are perfectly comfortable with it. You know, they'll be going, oh, that's nice, he stopped. What shall I have for lunch? You know, it's fine. It's not a problem. And people do perceive it as a problem. Obviously, if you've lost your track, if you're relying on memory to give a talk and the chain has broken and you're cast adrift, that's a bit stressful. I've seen people on TED stages do that and have that experience. What happens at TED? The audience start to applaud. They're saying, we're with you, don't worry, we're here to listen to you, it's okay. And the person then, you know, they're looking all red and sweating and flustered and breathing heavily, and they can go off stage and get notes and come back and resume. And it's fine if you, by the way, that is people's biggest fear about public speaking. And I mean, I don't rely on memory. I use slides. I know I can see presenter view on my screen. I know what I'm going to be talking about next. I don't read. I don't think reading writing is as good as speaking. So I am extemporizing all the time, but I know what's coming next. So I don't have that fear. And even if you did, you know, if you're calm and confident, you say, ladies and gentlemen, I am so sorry. I've completely forgotten what I was going to say next. Would you give me a minute? I'm just going to go and check my notes. People will be absolutely fine with that. It's not a problem. They'll be thinking, oh, that was brave. Wish I could do that. So silence needs to be your friend so that you don't feel uncomfortable with gaps, with stopping, I do like leaving gaps. And I think you could, obviously if it's clunky or irrelevant or inappropriate or just done for effect, that's, doesn't mean much. But if you say something incredibly important and you want people to receive it and get it, you can then stop. As you say, let them absorb it for a few seconds. And it makes all the difference in the world. I love silence.
I remember being coached to deliver a TED talk about 4 years ago. And my coach at the time said exactly that. When we arrived to the venue, there was not the ability to see your slides in front of you. All we had was a countdown timer, and the slides were obviously behind us. And I'd memorized the talk. And I remember getting to about the 12-minute mark where I posed a rhetoric question. And at that moment, I'd asked the audience to close their eyes and to imagine a future where, and this had to do with women's health. And as soon as I asked the question, every conversation I'd had in my healthcare career with women, with mothers, with carers, came flooding into the center of my brain, and it made me feel quite emotional. And the chain broke. And fortunately, the audience still had their eyes closed. So I was able to turn around and quickly look at the slide I was on to recalibrate and reset before they realized what was going on. And then I closed out the talk after that. And I remember at the end of that, the crowd was very gracious, and I sat down and I was completely exhausted. I've never felt more spent in my entire life going through that process. And I think it cured me of knowing that, you can recover off the back of those kind of things. I've never had a problem since. But I hear you. It's acknowledging that the crowd is there usually to listen and to take on board what you've got to say is a very important thing to keep in mind before you walk on stage.
And another big lesson from what you had there, of course, is something, I talk about the PPD of public speaking. The first P is prepare. Sorry, the first P is practice, which we've talked about, actually practicing what we do. The second P is prepare. And that involves checking with the venue what the facilities are. And, something I always, always stipulate is, there's a table in front of me, my Mac is on the table, I can see the screen, I need an HDMI lead on stage, I need a power lead on stage, blah, blah, blah. That's in, always, always, always there. It doesn't always work. People try and do clever things like, oh, no, we'll have your presentation at the back. It'll be fine. And then they didn't put the right font in and the designs are all messed up. And somebody at the back is having to cue the slide advances, which are critical for me when I'm talking, and it's out of sync and so forth. Well, you just have to deal with those things. But checking the venue's capable. What do you mean you don't have a projector? My whole thing is I show videos. You don't want to be stuck in that one. Having said that again, you also need a fallback. You need plan B. And, I've seen plan B wonderfully at TED a few times. Once in Oxford at TED Global, the very first TED Global, they had so much equipment in the old Oxford Playhouse, which was a geriatric building. They blew the whole electricity supply. And it took about half an hour to boot everything back up. They had so many computers that had to be booted in a certain order and so forth. Well, there happened to be an opera singer in the audience who went up on stage and gave us a recital. Well, what a great opportunity for her to be a hero in TED. And just in the same way, I remember at TED in Monterey, the BBC were doing a thing live on stage and the feed went. And they were all fumbling about. And a guy next to me, but one, stood up and started shouting. I thought, will you be quiet? You very noisy person. Oh, it's Robin Williams. He went down onto stage and gave us a 20-minute, absolutely hysterically funny stand-up, off-the-cuff show. So, being able to do something if the power goes down, if the slides don't work, if the sound system's gone, think about these things. And have a fallback, and then you can be a hero too.
I love all of that. When we think about the power of storytelling and how important that is to bringing people's imagination on a journey where the outcome might not be as clear as we would like to have it, I often correlate a very successful partnership with very strong story-based narrative. And I'm not trying to suggest for a second that this is a hand-waving exercise where just believe in the story and all will be fine. Obviously, there's a lot of depth that comes to this, but there is something quite profound in the way that an orator is able to communicate a story repeatedly and where it never gets old. When somebody comes to you for advice, coaching advice, like what we talked about for much of this episode, and they ask you about what is the best way to craft a story. Obviously, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. But when you think about that and the way you help them sort of think through the design of a story and the way that listening plays a role and speaking plays a role, what is your counsel to them, knowing that they may need to tell that story for years and years and years in order for progress to be achieved?
Well, you're right, storytelling is extremely important, and it's another dying skill, isn't it? Once upon a time, that was the evening's entertainment. Everybody was sitting around a fire telling stories. Now, we don't do that anymore because we've got people spending hundreds of millions of dollars on creating stories that we all sit and just absorb passively. So we've become an audience rather than active storytellers. Which is sad. Up here in Orkney, there are people still doing it. We have a storytelling festival, and Scotland's quite good for that generally. And stories are, you know, they can be apocryphal. They can be legends, myths, and all those kind of things which weave many people together. Or it could be the story of the founding of an organization which weaves an organization together. And I remember years ago doing some work with Honda, and the story of him and how he started the organization and the original things that he invented and so forth was woven through every part of that organization. They were all completely aware of the heritage, and it kind of informed the way they behaved in the here and now as well. I think podcasting is a great boon because it allows us to revisit storytelling. And audio, the comeback of audio in that way, I think is really important. I'm surprised more organizations aren't using that internally to tell stories. Mm. You know, the founder, maybe there are recordings of the founder talking to people and doing things, and you can weave together a wonderful audio documentary, which is moving and inspiring and much better than a, you know, on-ramp 2-hour induction talk or something from somebody. So in terms of inculcating the values of an organization, I'm assuming it's got some, into the new recruits, which is one of the hardest things. You know, it all dissipates, doesn't it? I mean, it's fine when you're growing from 1 to 12. That was my experience with TPD. 12 is about the most people you can get around a table in a restaurant. And I think that's significant. Because the moment you go past that, you've got the other table where the boss is not. So you start to have a sort of us and them. And then once you get past about 30, 40, 50 people, it's, who's that? Oh, yeah, they've been with us for a week. Oh, really? You kind of lose that family unless you are really diligent about walking around all the time and, you know, you can do your best. But once it gets to 100, 200, you've lost contact with the grassroots and they need to know something. They're not going to get it from you individually. So I think story in that sense is really important. And externally, I mean, there are a proliferation now of agencies. No, there is a proliferation of agencies around the world who focus on story and purpose-driven businesses telling stories as opposed to marketing. It's telling a story. So I think we're kind of seeing a renaissance of story. And it can be a classic story with a hero and a journey and a villain or challenges and tools and helpers and, you know, all the things that we know from Star Wars and Lord of the Rings and whatever. Or it can be a much more personal story, like the little story I told about my mum, which was true in the TED Talk, talking about negativity. Mm. You know, when I took in a newspaper to her when she was in the hospital having hurt her hand towards the end of her life. And I said, oh, look, it's October the 1st. And she said, I know, isn't it dreadful? Well, you know, that sums up overwhelming negativity as well as anything I could possibly think of. And it was true. And it was what happened. And I had that reaction to it. You know, So they can be very short, or, you know, just think of Ken Robinson's wonderful story in his number one of all time TED Talk about the little girl in the drawing class. I won't spoil it, and people should go off and see that immediately if they haven't seen it before.
I will link to that straight away. Yep.
But that summed up his entire talk in a 20-second story, which was brilliant and memorable and wonderful. So, yes, I think storytelling is magical, and I think we need to rediscover it in the strongest possible terms.
I have two other questions for you before we get into the rapid fire, which has become famous, the last five questions of any conversation that we have here. Let me ask you, when it comes to partnerships that have surprised you, maybe the exemplar partnerships that you hold true as being the ones that really ignited or opened your eyes to the power of partnering with someone else or with another organization, what is that case study that keeps front of mind when you contemplate the idea of entering into a partnership or trying to drive people together when you can see opportunity for a partnership?
It's a broad church, isn't it? The term partnership, and you can be talking about suppliers, consultants, business partners, mm-hmm. Organizations with whom you partner, joint ventures and so forth. I've never forgotten the phrase that a very wise printer who was a huge partner to my publishing company said. He said, I've only got three principles: have fun, make money, and do business with people you like. Well, I don't think you can get too much better than that. If you have the right sense of somebody, and most of my partnerships in life have been with individual people. So it's the third of those which has really been important to me. Whether it's, you know, my old friend Rod Banner, when I started TPD, when he was there when I left my previous company, he gave me a roof over my head. He rented me a desk. I helped him. He helped me. You know, I helped create a piece of research which really established his company. And then he gave me the resources I needed to establish mine. So that kind of partnership, it's always been to me about somebody I like and trust. That drives it. I've had experiences where that hasn't been in play and they've not turned out that well. There's a gut feeling here. There's an intuition. I've learned to go with my intuition, definitely. So that trust, I think, is core.
I couldn't agree more. I look at the state of the world right now and I don't see it in great shape. I see there's a lot of division. There are many things not going to plan. We have large problems that I don't think we fully understand nor how to really address. And they're things that transcend generations and cultures. And there's a lot of complexity there. One of the antidotes, I think, or one of the potential antidotes for that, I think, is the capacity for leaders to think differently about how they can come together with their companies, their people, their influence to try and affect a very different kind of outcome. We see this in the Pacific Islands all the time where nations are very small and they just don't have a footprint or a population to do everything themselves. So they band together with other island nations to make their region more safe or more secure or more prosperous. What do you think leaders are missing about the potential to engage in partnership to affect an outcome that they may have already realized they can't do themselves?
Well, I think a lot of the time it's clarity in alignment. You know, we're seeing that in Europe at the moment with the threat of Russia and with, you know, the economic difficulties with the refugees from all over the world who are going to be coming in increasing numbers as climate change renders large swathes of the Middle East uninhabitable. It's, you know, these things are going to go on and there's a lack of alignment, I think, where parochialism, local interest, xenophobia, the old human issue of fear and hatred of difference. These things are really in the way and the alignment doesn't seem to be there. So they're not setting any clear goals. There's no vision that I see. You know, what is Europe going to be like in 10 years? I've not seen anybody talk about where it's headed. it seems to be all about managing today's problems, not having a clear strategy to arrive at that place at that time. And if there were a strategy, there's not a lot of review going on of whether we're on track or not. So there are a constant series of knee-jerk reactions to things. It's all very reactive. And I think partnership needs to be proactive. I mean, you're doing this for a reason. There's a destination. And without that, it can't really work very well. So I think that's the biggest thing that's missing, clarity of alignment and goals.
For anyone who is listening to this or watching this, I hope while you've been doing this, whilst I would have liked you to have been paying full attention to this conversation, I suspect people have gone to look at the show notes or have looked for other resources. And I strongly recommend that you look at the domain that is right behind Julian right now, juliantreasure.com, but look at the TED Talks in the order that we've put them. We'll add the other ones we've mentioned in this episode as well. They are something else. And this has just been for me, Julian, a complete masterclass in how to think about the way we communicate and the way we listen, the way we seek to understand. So I just can't thank you enough for the time that you've spent with me today.
Oh, thank you.
I would love to take you through. Oh, thank you. I would love to take you through the rapid fire 5 questions. You okay if we hit those now?
Sure thing.
All right. Here's the first question. Complete this sentence. Partnership is?
I think partnership is commitment. Personal partnership, business partnership, whatever it is. If you're not committed, forget it.
Question 2. What content are you loving at the moment?
Well, as a musician, music has to be in there. And I am adoring Stephen Wilson's new album, The Harmony Codex, which is one of the most extraordinary albums that I've ever heard, particularly for anybody who's got a 5.1 surround sound system. Get the DVD, mind-blowing. So that, and then Substack and Notion I'm posting on Substack, and I love Substack. I think it's creating a new model for creators, and it's a very exciting place. And I've recently discovered Notion, which I'm enjoying hugely, as I've always been looking for somewhere to put all that stuff that I think of every minute. And Notion appears to be that, which is wonderful for me. And the other thing is I've been working with Ally Studios in Los Angeles to create an AI me, which is pretty nearly complete now. And I've been talking to it this morning. That's quite exciting. I'm kind of loving that, although it's spooky. But that I think is the content.
That's fantastic. Well, I'm looking forward to learning more about that. We might talk about that off air. That sounds like a fascinating project. What's the worst piece of advice you've ever received and why?
I think it was to sell TPD Publishing. It would have been, in retrospect, and I don't do regret or resentment. They're not helpful emotions, and I really don't indulge in them. But I try and learn. It would have been far better in retrospect to not to have sold that business and to have launched the sound agency out of it. Because the sound agency was all about brands connecting through sound, and TPD Publishing, or Just Communication as it eventually became, that was all about brands communicating with written words and pictures. So it was just a different medium, really. And I think I created a wonderful company. And there are still people who have reunions for that business. You know, we had Shiatsu coming in every week. We had wonderful, you know, the whole thing was, it was a passion place. And once it got sold into a big agency group, it was a bit like the Borg. It got assimilated and it doesn't exist anymore at all. You know, within 2 years, it didn't exist. It got moved into another office, and then the people just, you know, got watered down, and eventually there was no brand anymore. So I regret that. And no, I don't regret it. I've learned from it. Just said I don't do regret. So yeah, that was a bad piece of advice, was to sell at that time.
When you see a potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
Listen. That'd be it. Listen. Listen to them. Understand.
I love
that. That's intuition going.
I love that answer. And I could have predicted you would say that. I'm so glad you did. Final question. I should say that every time I ask this question, I get asked back, can I have more than one? So take three or four, as many as you need. What's the one thing you're deeply grateful for right now?
Well, I would say three then, if I may. My family, my wonderful partner, Jane, and our two gorgeous daughters, Holly and Sapphire, and my older children, Ben and Alice, my family. And living here in Orkney would be number two. It's the most beautiful place you can imagine. And it's remote and it's quiet and it's wonderful. And number three is music. I don't think I could live without music. You know, that ridiculous description of it as audio, what was it, audio candy floss or something by Steven Pinker. I so disagree with that. There isn't a human society on this planet that doesn't have music. It springs up independently everywhere. And it has the most dramatic effect on my soul, my happiness, you know, my spirituality. I am deeply grateful for music.
Julian, I am deeply grateful for your time today. I know we've just gone over the time that we had for this conversation, but it has been one of my all-time favorites. And I just want to say thank you for the time. We will link to all of the details in the show notes. And if you would like to engage directly with Julian, I know that he welcomes that. It is plastered all over his website to engage with him if you would like to. And I highly recommend it. It has been a tremendous conversation. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Phil. It's been a great pleasure for me too.
Thanks for listening to the end of this episode of Partnership Plus. If you like what you heard, you can share this episode via text message. And if you'd like to build your business partnership muscle, my free weekly newsletter called Wednesday Partnership will help you do just that. You'll find a link in the show notes. Finally, I'm big on encouragement and love to see people be in motion towards their ambitions. So if you know someone who might be struggling, reach out to them with a quick message of encouragement. It could change their life. Thanks again, and I'll see you in the next episode.